Think about how many thousands of people you've met in your lifetime. How many are acquaintances? How many are friends? How well do you know any of them? I'm your host, Steve Waxman, and I want to get to know people a little bit better. I want to find out about the journey they've taken in their lives to get to where they are today. These are my conversations with human beings. Way back in 1988, guitarist Rick Emmett stunned fans when he left the successful Canadian rock group Triumph to pursue a solo career. He left many questions on the table in the wake of his departure, most of which he answers in Chapter 5 of his autobiography, Lay It on the Line. Now, when I call a book an autobiography, I'm using air quotes, because this is also a self-help book and an instructional guide to songwriting and making your way through the music industry. Lay It on the Line is also much like Rick's career. Why just be a rock star when you can also be a columnist, a jazz guitarist, a baseball coach, a teacher, and a poet? As he proved with his 2021 book of poetry, Reinvention.
Yeah, all right, sure, yeah. I thought you were already rolling.
No. We're going to roll now. First of all, congratulations on, this is the second book, right? This is the poetry book and now this?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And that was the contract that ECW, they didn't insist on it, but I kind of knew, look, if I don't give them a memoir, they'll never really want to put out a poetry book. Whoever makes money on poetry books. So, it was a two-book deal. But I also have another poetry book that's sort of in the can with them. Okay. They're contemplating, like, when shall the release date be? And I've just finished another project called 10 Telecaster Tales, which is an album and a book. And so, and they're pretty keen on the idea of this, that, there's going to be, a symbiosis between these two things. I'm just going, picking back through it myself. So I end up being fairly prolific in this writerly kind of mode. And I keep rolling with it, and I don't have to go on the road anymore and play gigs and stuff. So it doesn't, and I don't have to go to the college and teach anymore. So I don't have any of these things that used to interrupt my, flow of diarrhea.
Okay. So there are so many different ways that I could start this. There's so many different places for me to go. I'm going to actually now go completely off script here just for a second, because you said, I don't need to go on the road anymore. And you have about 20 guitars behind you.
Yeah. Well, see, this is the thing. So sometimes the mood strikes you and you go, I wonder what it would sound like if I played it on a Les Paul. And then you go, I wonder if I played it on an arch top electric. Oh, I wonder if I played it with flat wound strings instead of just regular rock strings. So I can sort of indulge myself in that regard. But the truth of the matter is I could pare this down probably to about, as you said, you've got seven. Like, yeah. I could get it down to about, half a dozen kind of, and go, this is perfectly workable and feasible. Having said that, I was a guy that, over the years, you're playing an album and it's like, hey, I could borrow a resonator guitar, in order to play this part on this record, or rent one, or I could buy one cheap and have it around whenever I wanted it. And so slowly but surely, they start accumulating a sitar guitar, a resonator guitar, a 12-string guitar, Now, the other thing, Steve, is that I had the lovely indulgence of endorsement deals with Yamaha for many years, where they would say, well, let us make you something. What are you dreaming about? Let us fulfill your dreams. And so then you do that, and then you go out on a tour and you use that guitar, and then you come back off the tour and you sit around for a bit, and then you go, now I'm dreaming about something else. And so then they go, okay, well, we'll indulge that too. And I was with Yamaha for 25 years.
Yeah.
And then I went to Gibson for a while. I went to Godan for a while for their live acoustic hybrid kinds of guitars. So that's why there's so many of them.
Okay. So it's interesting. So while I was reading the book, I was going through your catalog and listening to the variety of records that you've made over the years. And it's what occurred to me was this autobiography, and I'm making the air quotes, this autobiography, yes, is much like your musical career. It's not just, yeah, an autobiography.
Yeah.
It's a self-help book. It's a book about what it's like to be in the music industry, not just necessarily as an artist. It's also about the business of music and how to deal with it. It's so many different things. So much like you didn't plan your musical career to go the way it did and all the twists and turns, but it ended up that way. What about the book?
Well, I mean, you know, you sit down and the first question I think anybody asks themselves is, so how much is it going to be autobiography? How much is it going to be memoir? And there are shades, right? A memoir is more, these are the things I remember and the stories I'd like to tell and anecdotes. And an autobiography is more like, okay, I was born, my mother's side of the family came from blah, blah, blah. So, you know, there's all of those things that when you're going to sit down and do it, those are the things you want to hit on. The other side of it for me was that, the most success I'd had was as a rock star in a band called Triumph, and they're putting out documentaries. And I'm going, well, it's lovely, but it's the story of Triumph and the three of us coming together. It's not my story. My story started long before I was in that band. And then after I left it, I did way more shit than I did when I was in it, you know, and found my time in it. You know, sometimes a little limiting and frustrating. And you know, there were things that they're not going to tell in a Triumph documentary that I'd like to tell in my own book. So those are things that you're going, okay, I got to cover this stuff. You got to hit on these kinds of things. Now, I have a website where I'd had a members forum for 20 years. And I'd had fans that could, you know, pay an amount of money, come there every year, every day if they want, and post up a question and go, hey, Rick, remember the time you played in Kansas and this thing happened? Hey, you remember there was a guy in a red T-shirt in the second row when you played in, you know, Baltimore? And I would get these questions and deal with them. And those folks are the people that like me the most and have been, you know, loyal and supportive for such a long time. And so here's all these questions. And I could go, great. So I said to my web person, hey, put all those answers that I wrote there over the years all in one file and send it to me. And it was over 5,000 single space pages. And I go, okay, that's a lot of shit I'm going to have to chew through, you know? So there was that. And the other side of it is, of course, I was a teacher for a couple of decades in a college teaching music and teaching, you know, in the beginning, music business. And then songwriting and functioning as a directed studies mentor, helping people with recording projects. And, you know, so that was sort of like I went from being pontificating dog up on his hind legs, barking at students and wondering why they're doing so poorly on their written assignments. And then, you know, gradually getting to the point where you're kind of like psychiatrist, counselor. Shoulder to cry on, you know, all of those kinds of things. So that gives you a perspective on if you're going to write a book and it's going to be about a life in music, maybe what I should do is show any possible reader what a life in music is like and what, you know, not just any life in music, but in particular, this one, which had its, as you say, it bounced around like a pinball in a game, you know, like I did a lot of weird different things, but I think there was a value in that. It was, my book was going to be different than other memoirs. I think anybody that reads memoirs is going to go, well, this one's different, you know? And I go, good. Like that's one of the things that I always kind of set out to do is try to have something in there that people go, well, I didn't expect that one.
And that's, quite honestly, that's the case from the very beginning. Because when I started reading the book, I was like, oh, well, this is great. He gets right into the story. And it's like, this is not a typical autobiography. And then it sort of becomes a typical autobiography. Yes. But then it becomes the story of Triumph. But then it becomes the self-help, and then it becomes a look back at a totally different part of your career. And at first, obviously, it was like, this is crazy. And then I started, and that's when I started listening to the catalog. because I, you know, I had heard Triumph songs and I, you know, but I was never, I didn't buy the Triumph albums and I wasn't quite sure where you had gone afterwards. And then it's like, holy cow, it's like this album is completely different than that album and is completely different than the next album. And that's what this book is.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Now, of course, from my perspective, you know, I'm sitting and I'm dealing with this pile of stuff, you know, all of these written words, and how am I going to organize it? You know? And so then the idea of chapters becomes a thing of, well, they don't necessarily have to be sequential. You know, they don't have to be chronological. You know, you can bounce around because, you know, somebody turns the page and you can put a number at the top and, you know, give it a title. I mean, picking the epigraphs that went in there was a really fun thing for me to kind of go, how can I encapsulate what I'm about to do for the next 30 pages? You know, oh, I'm going to search around and find something that kind of, and then I feel like, okay, so now I've made this so it's a, I can put it anywhere in the book that I want. You know, it could function as a, well, obviously there's going to be a few chapters that are going to be, oh, this is a good one to start. I mean, how many times have you picked up a rock star's memoir? And it always starts with, you know, like the Keith Richards one, it's like the first chapter, it's the one where he's going to really badmouth a bad thing that happened with Mick.
Yeah.
Because his editor has read it and gone, okay, this is the best story in the book. Let's put it right up front. Let's grab them right from the get-go, you know. That's a fairly common thing. You need, there's a, Keith Moon once said, they were asking him about, you know, playing rock shows. And Keith Moon said, look, you start with a bang, you end with a bang, everything in the middle, nobody gives a shit about, you know. And that's, it's kind of the truth of anything in show business, you know. So I'm sure Shakespeare was sitting around writing plays and going, got to start with a bang and end with a bang. You know, like I got to grab everybody when the curtain goes up. So anyhow, yeah, I think storytelling is its own. It's its own kind of art and craft. And it's a little bit different than the art and craft of, say, you know, being a rock star in spandex pants. It's a little bit different than being a teacher. Like there's a lot of teaching that's storytelling, a lot of it, you know, there's a lot of teaching that's like playing a show, like being a musician and doing a gig. But they all have their own different things. And getting to be a writer has been a really interesting, fun experience for me because I take all of these other things and go, right, so how will it apply?
You know, it's funny. So I have a lot of questions here that I wrote as I was going through the book. And
sure.
As I go through these questions, and I'm going to go through them as I wrote them sequentially, they'll make no sense to people listening to this in terms of trying to follow along with the story. But they're all but they're all pulled out of the book. And I haven't written this one down, but this is the first one that comes to mind. And I was, you kept calling yourself a rock star. And yet at the same time, you are a very normal person. Yet at the same time, you're a very accomplished musician. So how do you, what does rock star mean to you? Because it means something different to, I think, everybody.
Yeah.
And you kept calling yourself a rock star in the book. And I kept thinking, is he being ironic saying it? Or does he seriously consider himself a rock star? I don't know.
A little bit of both. Because, of course, how can you look in the mirror and go, yeah, rock star? You know, like, it's just kind of like, and of course, like, let's go back a step, Steve. Yeah. If ECW Press is going to give me a deal to put out a memoir, you know, they're going to sign a contract and say, yeah, all right, you know, we want you to put a book. What is it that they're interested in? That the thing that really is going to make most people pick up the book is, oh, rock star. This is the story of a rock star. If it was like, here's the story of a college teacher, they're going to go, yeah, that doesn't really turn my crank, you know. So rock star is the sort of, it's the calling card. It's the thing. And of course, I'll give you some insight on another level. You know, when you get to a certain point, now you're talking to the person from the marketing department, what should the title of the book be? you know, and I've got a few titles I've been thinking about and, you know, wondering about and suggesting. And they go, well, Rick, have you had a look at all our rock star memoirs? I go, yes. And they go, and you know, the Bruce Springsteen one, it's called Born to Run. Right. I go, yes. So how many rock star memoirs, they just take their most successful single that they ever had, and that's the title of your book? I go, uh-huh. And they go, so, you know, the title of your book should be Lay It on the Line. Don't you think it's the most successful song? It's yes. When I get my soap can check, it's the, that's the one that earns me the most money every year. I go, okay, I can see that. So the idea of rock star, it's been something that I can't escape. It's been a part of my life. You know, and every facet of the book, like the stuff that's in there that's like, well, he was a college teacher, so there's going to be chapters that are like, you know, stuff that he taught at the school to kids. But when I was in on that faculty, it was like, hey, here comes the rock star. Hey, rock star, how's your day going? You know, like, that's who I was. It was my identity, you know. And whenever the school, the college itself was going to do some kind of dog and pony show, you know, there was one time where there was a meeting with PCAP, the Provincial Educational Quality Assessment Board. And, you know, they're going to have to get up and they're going to have some, you know, fireworks. It's a dog and pony show. And they go, hey, Rick, will you come and do the PCAP thing? I go, yeah, okay, sure, I'll come. Because I know what my, you know, this is my life, you know. I wore spandex pants and I played fancy guitars and, you know, I sang at the top of my lungs. And, hey, I was on the radio for a decade. You know, so that kind of stuff is the calling card. You can't escape it. But irony, absolutely. Do I actually look for it in art and in my creative life? Absolutely. I really want it because I think like any creative artist, what you like to do is have layers in the layer cake. You and the more the better, you know, like if somebody reads it for a, like, come on. You listen to Beatle records when you're a kid, right?
Some, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, now as an adult, you listen to the Begin and they're not the same. They had so much good value in them that every decade of your life, when you go back to them, there's something else to find there. That's how good they were at what they did. And so, you know, when it comes to writing a poem or writing a song or writing a book, I want to go layers. Irony. Oh, that's a good layer to have. You know, a sense of humor is a nice thing to have because it's disarming. It's something that makes people go, oh, he's not threatening. He's not angry. He's making jokes, you know? And you go, well, you know, you ever spent some time with a bunch of comedians in a room? Because those people have a lot, they got a lot of issues, you know. There's a lot of anger that they use humor to deflect. So I use irony. I use a sense of humor. I sometimes go deeper than your average guy would go writing a pop song, but that's me.
So, you know, you throughout the sentences, you've touched on everything we're going to touch on here as we talk.
Oh, that's like me too.
Oh my gosh. So the first question that I wrote, and I don't know where in the book I was reading when I thought of this, but do you ever feel victimized commercially by your own talent?
Victimized by my talent? No.
In as much as there's there's expectations because of the past, and then you've got all this creative energy and all this talent to do so many different things, and people are not necessarily going to follow them all.
Well, Mr. Waxman, let me tell you what my wife would say. That's not a problem. You know, like I would be complaining like, oh, geez, you know, what a horrible thing. The weight and the baggage of my, you know, career. Of the things that I've done in the past, and the expectations that people put on me because of my talent and my ability, she goes, ooh, you know, so hard. What a poor baby, you know, like, come on. Like, it's not like you're starving in the third world here, you know, like these are first world problems, you know? So, you know, pull up your big boy pants and, you know, do your job, like do the work. And so I don't, you know, the way you framed the question, like, I think any sort of creative work, which I would say, you know, playwrights, poets, novelists, at a certain point, it's a kind of a mutual exploitation kind of deal, you know, that you're making. You bring your creativity to the table and they go, okay, but we want to make money. You know, that's what we want to do here. Like, we're not going to make a movie for $14 million and not have some sort of expectation of getting our money back with interest. Like, that's how this works, you know? And that's true of anything. So, you know, I just think you have to be realistic, but this is the deal you're entering into. When you sign on the bottom line and the contract says recording artist, and you go, okay, so they're going to give me carte blanche. No, they're not. They're going to give you a lot of money and they want their money back, you know? So they're going to sit on you and sometimes they're going to be crushing you and it's hard to breathe. And you go, well, you know, I signed the deal, you know, I should have seen what was coming, you know? So no, I only when I'm in my weakest moments do I feel like I'm a victim.
Okay. There's so much in this book where, you know, you talk, your love of baseball, your love of coaching baseball, the life of being a professor or teacher. Are you considered a professor?
I never liked to think of that. You know, I had never got the degrees that would make you qualified to be that.
Okay.
Although, you know, they go, hey, want an honorary one? I go, yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, I'll take an honorary one. Thank you. But, you know, I'd never, for example, you know, got even a BA. Then you'd have to have an MA. Then if you want to be the head of the department, you're supposed to have a PhD. You're supposed to have a terminal degree. And I didn't have any of that, you know. And yet I was, for a while, I was the head of a department and I'm going, this isn't right. You know, I make a part, make, give me somebody that's got a PhD and let me, you know, co-run the department kind of. Of course, you know, the department, it's two people in it, three people in it. Like, you know, it wasn't that big a college, you know. Nevertheless, no, I, and professor, like, you do get up and you profess, you know, you go, okay, I have an idea here. Let me share this idea with you. See what you think of this. So you're professing certain kinds of things, but I was a teacher, you know, and as a teacher, I was more like a, you know, I was more like a rock star.
Well, okay. I don't know if you can talk to this, but let's see. You can talk to pretty much anything, I think. So the dichotomy of being a creative person trying to lead a non-creative life.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about non-creative is that it's hard for me to imagine how that works. You know, I think what you're talking about is more sort of vocation and that sort of thing. Because I think to be a good husband, to be a good father, creativity, it's important. You know, it's important in every facet of life. And certainly for me, it was important to make life meaningful for me, no matter what it was that I was doing. My life didn't seem to have purpose unless it was creative. You know, so, but certainly there are things, and the memoir does go into this in great sort of detail a couple of ways, that there's always this battle going on between the commercial side of what the creative business will bring to you, and then the artistic side, that's the one where you go, I don't want you to tell me what to do. I don't want the market to tell me what to do. I don't want a fan from 20 years ago to have to force me to do something today that's just the, you know, the latest book that I'm writing. I make an allusion to Paul Simon in two ways. He had a thing that was called One Trick Pony. And then later in life, he talked about in the lyric for You Can Call Me Al. It was like, I don't want to be a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard. And that's Paul Simon sort of, you know, railing against the bars of the cage, you know, like pushing at the envelope, going like, don't make me have to be the Paul Simon that I was 20 years ago, that you know, I'm not that guy anymore. And that's not the way creativity works. So you're always going to come into that kind of conflict, you know, and you're going to have to deal with it, you know, but again, big boy pants, you know, like that's not such a hard thing to do. That's the thing you have to do, you know, no matter who you are. If you were Picasso, you know, like, and in, here's an interesting thing about that, since I've raised that, Picasso would be the kind of guy that would say, like, I spent 40 years trying to learn to paint like an eight-year-old, you know, so there's that. So that's the whole thing too of, what are you railing about? What are you unhappy about? The non-creative life, like, that's a part of life, you know. Here's another angle on it. How do you get out of this life without your heart being broken over and over and over again by family members dying and horrible things happening in the news? Like, man, read your news feed every day, and it's terrifying. It's horrifying, you know. But, you know, you want to be creative? You're supposed to be offering something of value. So how do you play that balance game, you know? And, you know, if you're some painters, you paint Guernica.
Well, connected to that is actually my question. In the book, you admit that you are someone who needs order. And you know, creativity is spontaneity. Which is, so where's the, how do you deal with that conflict between the spontaneity of creativity and needing order?
Well, yeah, great question. Spontaneity is where it all starts. The spark, those things, that has to be there. And then I think it's very important to me, and I think to many types of art, that form should be something like an architect can't function without form being part of what's going on in this. You have to build it so that, you know, there's a door here and there's a window there. And, you know, in the case of a song, there's got to be something that sort of gets you into the song, and then the idea has to build. And then you get to a certain point and you want your chorus to kind of erupt and the lights come on and yabba dabba doo. And, you know, like, so there's development and in form that it's in all art. It exists. Having said that, you know, you go through this long process of developing an idea and working on it, but then this thing of spontaneity that you're describing, it does have to come back. There has to be something where, you know, I was writing something this morning and I was talking about, I get this idea and I try to start executing the idea as a writer, and I get it to a certain point, and I have to make it so that a listener is going to go, oh, I understand the idea you're driving at here. Oh, I feel the emotion you're driving at here. Then I have to be a performer and I have to play it. And as a person playing my own music, I have to try to find this thing again of, where's my joy in making this thing come to life? Like, and if I don't, somebody's going to listen to it and go, I don't get it. He's not engaged. He seems disengaged with the material. I go, how's that possible? I wrote it. But it is possible. It's very possible, because you're taking it for granted. You're not seeking the joy. You're not trying to find the thing that makes it boom happen, you know? And you have to be constantly seeking that. And, you know, I walk out on stage and I'm going to play a song for the 753rd time of my life. And it's like, what's going to turn me on here? What's going to make it be something? I just read Patrick Stewart's memoir, you know, the actor, the guy that was in Star Trek and stuff. Yeah. And he talked about how for years he was in the Royal Shakespeare Company, and he strongly adhered to this idea of, every night I got to go out there and I got to deliver the same thing. I got to do the same thing every night. And somebody finally said to him, Patrick, you're nuts. That's not what you're supposed to do. Every night when you go out there, you're supposed to make it so that the people sitting in the seats are given a unique experience. Every night has to be unique for the people that are there. And he went, mind blown. Like, and I think for a creative person, that's what you have to, that's that spontaneity thing. There does have to be this moment in what we do.
For sure. I, you know, it's the other thing, and related to all of what you just said, was the thought, I wondered, given, I think you're one of the smartest musicians intellectually that I've met in a long life of meeting musicians. And I just, as I was reading the book, I was like, do you ever suffer paralysis from your intellect while writing?
I think I'm not smart enough for that to happen.
Okay.
You know, like, I think because I'm looking for sort of the fun of it, the entertainment of it, the recreation of it, and recreation in its truest sense, like recreating yourself through an activity, you know, I think that makes it so that I don't end up, you know, despairing like a, I don't know, you know, a Nietzschean philosopher, or, you know, I also don't think I live in very dangerous times. So, although, you know, the rise of Trump could give one pause, but yeah, I mean, I think I was reading the other day about Spinoza, and the kind of, he had to be very careful in as a philosopher, as a thinker, because free thinking, it was totally what he was into. And the government was like, you know, the politics of the church and the influence of that made it so that, you know, but we live in times where, you know, it's not against the law to have free thinking, you know, and so I go, all right, well, good. I'm going to take advantage of that. You know, I'm not going to, start worrying about whether or not my own brain is going to create a problem for me. You know, I think that a good answer to your question is, and my book is very clear about this, is humility and modesty. Like, I really believe in the virtues and not the vices, you know, and the things that, you know, the deadly sins, whenever they start rising up, you know, greed and selfishness, and then there's a, you know, that's a dangerous thing in our society, and it always has been. And I think it's probably, have you read Sapiens by Harari?
No.
It's a pretty interesting kind of it's a look at, you know, the rise of human beings, and what essentially we're these greedy, selfish assholes that ruin everything. You know, make other genuses of you know, we go extinct. We ruin the world. You know, we're eating up this world and we're destroying it. And that's probably the bad side of things. The good side of it is that we can be modest and we can be humble and we can be kind and we can be these kinds of things to each other, to the world. You know, so you know, to answer your question, if I'm humble, then I should be kind to myself, I think, because I don't want to make it so that I can't, you know, think well tomorrow.
Yeah. So there's another great philosopher that I read. I feel like it's 30, 35 years ago now. It seems forever when I try to recall it. The great John Candy once said, first we rehearse and then we rehearse. And then I read the quote in your book. It's not much about as much about writing as it is about rewriting.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's true. I like that. First we rehearse, then we rehearse. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I you know, that's not, I don't think I originated that phrase. I think that's been around in you know, the writing education for an awfully long time, you know, certainly for songwriters. Now, having said that, you know, you mentioned earlier about spontaneity. there are moments, there are times where a song can come to you and it's almost like it's this gift that's arrived, you know. I think Leonard Cohen said once, look, if I knew where to find the good songs, don't you think I'd go there more often? You know, but there are times where you feel like you're like a radar dish and this thing is just channeling through you. And it's a beautiful moment of flow, which is, that's actually a technical term. There's a guy named Csikszentmihalyi he's a psychologist from University of Chicago. He's got some great books about the creative flow state of, you know, whatever, you know, the atomic scientist, and he leaves the house and he's forgot to put his pants on, you know, because he's in a flow state. His brain is doing something else. You're standing at the easel and you've been painting for 9 hours and you haven't even taken a piss, you know, and you're going, whoa, I guess I better go to the bathroom, you know. But that's it's a beautiful place to be. I also think it can be, it's like, the hippies are sitting around and they're smoking dope and they're writing their song. And then the next day when they're straight, they realize it's just a piece of junk. Like, it's awful. It goes nowhere. It makes no sense. But when they were writing it, they thought they were geniuses, you know? So I think there's that you can get in that flow state and then it can be delusional. You have to check it again. You know, you have to rehearse later, rewrite later.
So how would you compare your process of writing songs to writing prose or poetry for that matter?
There's a lot that they have in common. Certainly the search for the rhythms of things is, to me, that's almost the fundamental thing. At the heart of the thing, there's got to be a heartbeat, you know. And I look for that. I look for it to be hanging together in a rhythmic, flowing kind of way. And that's a storytelling-ish kind of thing that's common to all of them. I think the idea of poetry not being married to music makes it so that you can be much more esoteric. You can, and like, there's poems that I've written where it's more about the shape of the lines on the page, or it's more about the sound of the words. And in music, in writing songs, the sound of lyrics is important. You know, that it's an important thing, but the shape of the line has got to fit a melody. It's got to fit a rhythm. It's got to fit the landscape of the harmonic landscape of chord changes. So that's an entirely different game that puzzle's a little more complex. Stephen Sondheim, you know, great, great songwriter, but more Broadway, you know, show tunes kind of approach to the way that he did it. But he loved doing cryptic crosswords. It was just, you know, the way his brain, because to him, the writing of songs was like solving a cryptic crossword, you know, and putting these things, these puzzle pieces go together in this certain kind of way. And I think when you're writing, say, a book, a memoir, I've never written a novel, and I that frightens me. I don't think I'll attempt it ever in my life. It's too long a form. And I think it requires way too much discipline for a guy like me. But anyways, the writing of prose, I mean, I wrote a magazine column for 13 years for Guitar Player Magazine. And every month I had to, you know, organize my thinking in this way and put these words down. That's more a question of trying to be clear and articulate and trying to make it so that, and my wife would say sometimes, Rick, you don't have to tell people three times. Just tell them once, you know? And I go, yeah, but I want to surround the idea. I want to corral it. I need to build a triangle around it in order to make sure that everybody's going to get this. She goes, well, you just tell them once. You don't have to tell them. Anyhow, so I do think that when you write prose, there's that thing where you're trying to, it's more linear. You're trying to be a little more articulate. You know, this thing has to kind of flow along and then ba-boom. But I do like to have it be that you get to the last sentence of a paragraph and it goes, ba-boom. You know, it's got a little bit of a kick, you know, and then there's a gap and now you go to the next paragraph. And yeah, so that's you could say that's like songwriting, because of course a verse ends and something else begins, you know, like there is that. So there's a lot that's in common.
It's funny that you mentioned that you haven't written a novel. You don't think you could write a novel, because the next question that I actually have is asking about the process of writing the facts of your life in a song versus a fantasy when you're writing a fantasy story.
Yes. Yeah. Well, what we're driving at here maybe is the whole idea of getting to play God. And as a creative person, you know, writing a novel, I think writers, the novelists, really do get comfortable with the idea of, I create a character, the character is doing certain things. I'm going to sit down today. What is that character going to do? What's that character going to tell me it wants to do? You know, and that's what they're listening for. That's what they're channeling, you know. My life has been more about always channeling me, channeling myself. You know, how can I get more of me in there? You know, like writing my own songs and performing them, you know, writing my own poetry, and it's kind of about me. It's autobiographical, you know, that there's a reason why the poetry book was what it was. It was reinventing me, you know. I wasn't reinventing. Now, having said this, in the latest book of poetry that's sitting in the can waiting for somebody to publish it, I invented an auto-fictional kind of character, a guy named Alvaro Follis. And he's kind of like this guy, and it's me, but it's like, you know, and of course, in a way, it's like, you know, John Updike created Rabbit, you know, like he had his characters. Like, I think John Updike has had a few that he was channeling sort of, this is me in this book, you know. No, it's not more a question of myself. It's more a question of that it seems like it's such a huge thing to try to bite and chew. Like, it seems like it wouldn't fit in my mouth, like wouldn't fit in my head, you know, like poems and songs, they have a kind of a concision, you know, that makes it so they go, oh, I think I can take that on. I think I can handle that, you know. But a novel, I go, ooh, geez, it's weighty. It gets too deep. And I have a feeling that if I started one, I'd be at, like, you know, page 947, and my editor would be going, when is this thing ever going to end? But you keep bouncing around like a, you know, Rick, you're like a pinball in a pinball game. Yeah.
And you are, as proven by most of all your career.
Yes.
So I want to tell you a little bit of a story. When I started reading the book, I was probably a quarter of the way through, and I thought to myself, this could have been me. I have the same dreams. I wanted to be, I don't know, I probably wanted to be a rock star because I liked Kiss. But I wanted what you did and do. And then it reminded me, I worked with Chris Hadfield for a bit, the astronaut.
Oh, yeah.
And sure. I wanted to be an astronaut. And so we had this great conversation. He and I are born the same year, 1960. And we talked about our love of space. And while I was talking to him, I at one point I said to him, I now see what happened. You wanted to do it, and you did everything that it took to get there. And that's what made me think about when I was reading your book, because you're from Toronto. It's like, I could relate to you growing up in the areas that you grew up in. It's like, and you did it. You pursued it. There are some sacrifices you have to make. You certainly have talent, but not everybody with talent makes it.
No.
And so I'm reading, I now have this soaked into my head as I'm reading the book. And at one point, and it's funny, this is going to go back to the title of the book. At one point, before I got to the point where you said it yourself in the book, I thought to myself, this book should be called Ordinary Man.
Yes. And it was definitely a title that, you know, in my mind, I played with that idea because that was the first sort of autobiographical kind of song that I ever really wrote. Every song you write, everything you do is autobiographical in some sense, in some way. But that was about looking at myself in the mirror as a rock star, you know, and seeing this guy that was now a rock star and going, yeah, but, you know, you're not really a rock star. You're not really, you don't believe that stuff, you know. But the idea you raised is an interesting one of, you know, you do what is necessary in order to make it happen, right? And I was in a band with one of my best friends, and we were living the dream. We was like, I wanted to be in a progressive rock band, and this was the band before Triumph. And we were playing this music that every night I couldn't wait to get on stage to play because I just loved what this band was all about. And we were making, you know, $1,200 a week playing the B and C lounges on the Ontario bar circuit. And, you know, half the time the people in the audience were going, you know, they look at you and the whole audience is like the RCA dog. Their heads are tilting sideways going, what is this that I'm hearing? You know? And then the Triumph guys came along and sort of offered me, hey, we're going to be doing this thing and we're going to be blowing off flash pots and it's going to have the biggest PA and the biggest lights. And it's going to be, this, you know, and I was going, oh yeah. And then I went and jammed with them and I was, you know, listened to them play. And I went, oh yeah. You know, like it was not this incredible aesthetic kind of thing that I was chasing as an artist. But I sat and talked to these guys and I went, these are the smartest musicians I ever met. These guys are, they know how to make this happen on a level that I've never even really dreamed about. I can enter into a partnership with these guys and what I can bring to the table, I think we can make this happen. You know, I think I can make this happen, but certainly not without them and the skill sets that they possessed. And that was the right choice. And years later, you know, the guy that I sort of stabbed in the back to leave the band, you know, my best friend, Denton Young, he says to me, Rick, you did the right thing. You did the thing that you had to do in your life. That was the thing you had to do. And when you make those decisions, when those things happen, you know, you're not really aware that this is, oh yeah, this is a Malcolm Gladwell tipping point. You know, oh, this is where, this is the watershed moment of my life. You're just kind of going along and you're stumbling sometimes, you know? And again, Paul Simon, there's a line somewhere about incidents and accidents, you know? And I go, that's kind of, sometimes that's what it is. You just kind of, you've made a choice. This thing happens and, you know, the pinball bounces and you manage to land in the socket that's the bonus socket. And you didn't, you know, it was just luck. It was just kind of serendipity. But I think that's how careers sometimes happen, especially in music business. I don't know about other businesses. I really only know the one I was in. So,
well, I think that what comes across to me as someone who doesn't know you is that you're incredibly self-aware. That comes across in the book, which is really nice. Again, as an outside observer, I think that the way you describe yourself as a member of Triumph is, I can't speak for other people, but for myself, that's the way I would have seen you too, as there are those two guys and you. And I'm not saying that they're separate from you, although apparently there was some business that was separate. But I mean, I know Mike the way most people in the music industry know Mike. He's always out there. He's a very, very friendly person. He's wonderful and all that stuff. I don't know Gil that well. I've only met him a couple of times, but he's a particular kind of character. And even before I was in the music business, when I just knew the videos, when I knew the albums, it did seem to me like you were separate from them somehow. And I didn't think of articulating it, but even if I tried to articulate it, I couldn't have because I didn't know the band at all. But now, having read the book, it all becomes plain as day, as how different you all were.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, the process of being you know, a public personality, of offering creative work to the public in order to try and have a career, it led me to this thing where, you know, I had long hair and I was jumping around and playing in a rock band. And in some ways, I bet you there would be like high school teachers of mine that would say, no, that I could definitely see that, you know, cocky, arrogant little son of a bitch with a quick mouth. Like, it doesn't surprise me that he, you know, that class clown sort of became a rock star. But, you know, you've read the book, so, you know, the class clown was a defense mechanism for the fact that I was younger and smaller and shorter. And, you know, when I went into grade 9, the curls all looked like they were right out of Cosmo magazine. And I felt like I was this, you know, kid still carrying his lunch pail to school, you know, like, so it was like, well, how do I survive this? And so that whole idea of sort of becoming quick with my mouth and quick with my wit and then quick to offer my creativity, like, oh, I'll be the guy that can draw the cartoon on the board. Oh, I'm the guy that can, you know, by the end of high school, I was doing the announcements on the PA every morning, you know? So there was this thing of a cockiness, an arrogance kind of showbiz, but it was never me. And the other side of it is that I'd stand in front of students and I would say, look, when you offer people something, you have to try to put something in there. This is the stuff that money can't buy. That's what adds value, is that it has to be what money can't buy. And I think the bands that do that, and U2 would be a good example, they've lasted a long, long time because they've got a higher purpose. They sort of see themselves in a way of, no, there's something that's more important here. And, you know, my connection to an audience was always the most important thing to me, you know, more than the money, more than the career, or, you know, is this good for my career? Is it going to build? And I think maybe when you perceive a difference between me and, you know, Mike and Gil and the band, those guys were very much in a role, and this was their job and this was their gig. But it wasn't, that's not who they really were. They weren't really putting who they really were into what they did. That's not the way it worked for them. But for me, more and more, it was like, no. How do I put myself at risk? How do I strip naked, climb up onto the high wire and with no safety net? That's what I need to do in order for this to be valuable, in order for this to make sense for me. So, you know, the fact that I bounced around a lot later on in my life after I got out of Triumph was because I kept wanting to take that risk. That was the thing that kind of turned my crank. You know, that's what made it work for me.
You know, it's perfect because it actually leads to my final question.
Okay, good.
How do you think you'll be remembered versus how do you want to be remembered?
Wow.
I'm going for the mic.
Sorry?
I'm going for the mic drop.
Yeah, well, yeah, the question itself is the mic drop, and I can't answer it. Let me say this. Because I've had a lifetime of making things and they go to the public, and then, you know, 5 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later, people will say, well, what about this, about that? And I go, I never thought of that. I never knew it had that shade to it. I never knew that it had that, you know, kind of, and sometimes people are so wrong, you know, that like they hear a song and they go, oh, this is what that song's about. I go, no, it's not. Like, there's no way it was like that. So I'm giving you the background to say that I think that there's no way I can predict what how people will perceive it, you know, long after I'm gone. You know, this memoir will now sit on a bookshelf. Maybe my grandchildren will pull it down and have a look. It's possible, but I kind of doubt it, to be honest with you. I think they'll be moving on with their own lives, and life, it's changing so rapidly and so fast now. I'm not sure that the idea of reading a book might not be something that even, you know, occurs to somebody, say, two or three generations from now. So, you know, how do I want to be remembered? I want to be remembered as somebody that tried to, like Boy Scout. I just want to leave the campsite better than I found it. You know, I that's a fairly simple kind of a thing, but, you know, why do I write songs? Because I feel like this is the best thing I can do, you know, for the world. Like, why am I writing a book? Well, you know, maybe it's an add-on to this whole thing of trying to make the world a better place, you know. And it might not, you know, it might be forgotten and in a delete bin. I've seen that with some of my albums, you know, like it does happen, you know. And there's not much I can do about that. Like, I can't really affect the marketplace. The marketplace has got its own thing, and it's got its own, man, you know, like, you know, you and I are having a lovely conversation here, and it's very nice. And you broach some of the questions in ways that make me feel, you know, important and great and everything. And, you know, but the truth of the matter is, like, did Rick Emmett ever win a Juno Award? No. The only one we ever got was like, well, they lasted long enough, we should put them in the Hall of Fame. So, you know, we got one for hanging in there. We got one for persistence. We never actually won one for anything that we actually ever did in the course of time. And that was because the marketplace was always something that was out ahead of us. And, you know, the like, I'd go to the Junos in the 80s and Rush would win. You know, and then Glass Tiger would win, or Platinum Blonde would win, or, you know, like, and Triumph wouldn't win, you know. And it was because we weren't with the label that had the largest voting block inside the Juno, you know, or we couldn't get enough critics to like us for their votes within the voting block of the Junos, you know, kind of thing. So I'm saying that to illustrate the idea of the market. You know, there's things that the market does that you can't really control it, you know. And then when you do have success, you go, I never imagined that would happen. I never imagined that song would get a bullet on the hit parade. You know, wow, that's great. That's cool. But you try for it. But when it happens, it's kind of unexpected because the failure rate is awfully high, you know. So I don't know. Like, to answer your question, finally, I would say, I would like to be thought of like a nice Ty Cobb. And so let me explain that. Ty Cobb was an asshole of a human being. You know, he was the greatest hitter in the history of Major League Baseball. His lifetime batting average was .367. I used to teach this to students all the time. It was the highest batting average of all time. But it meant that 6 times out of 10, when he went up to the plate, he failed. And failure is what you've got to understand about life. That's how life really works. You know, you just got to keep going up to the plate and swinging and, you know, hoping that you're going to knock one in. So you can get into the Hall of Fame as in baseball as a 300 hitter. If you can hit it 3 times out of 10, you know, and if you can only hit it 2 times out of 10, you're probably not going to be able to keep your job. Like, so the difference between success and failure, yeah, is between, you know, 2 out of 10 and 3 out of 10. That's the margin, you know. So I think it would be a really fantastic thing if 10 years after I'm dead, 100 years after I'm dead, people will go, you know what, that guy was like a 305 hitter. I would go, yes, thank you for that. You know, that would be great. I would love that, you know, because that would be Hall of Fame shit, you know. But I do think I'm kind of a scratch hitter and I hit him the opposite way. And I'm like, I'm more like a 225, 230 hitter, you know. And if I go into a slump, I wouldn't even be hitting my weight, you know. That's the, they call that the Mendoza line, if you can't hit your own weight, you know. And I think it could be for me, you know. When I first started playing baseball, I could run really fast. And so I learned how to bunt, even playing slow pitch and not slow pitch, fastball and softball. And I would bunt the ball and I would get to first, and then I would steal second and steal third, and then I would steal home. And I won the first year I played, I won most valuable player in the league. And I don't think I ever hit the ball out of the infield. Well, you know, maybe two or three times I hit ground balls that, you know, found a hole. But I saw, you know, I don't know. I'm a scratchy kind of hitter. I'd settle for 3 out of 10. That'd be good.
I hope that you've enjoyed my conversation with Rick. One of the things that I got from his book was the idea of rock star as a vocation. Apart from the smoke bombs and spandex pants, Rick has led an extraordinary life, as most of us do. Take some time to relay it on the line and see how much of yourself you find in Rick's story.